Cold warriors, spies, agents, and intelligence officers. As Eva Horn claims, the most important weapon is knowledge about the enemy, and thus, in her opinion, the Cold War was not an arms race, but rather a knowledge race. While the refugees' and emigres' stories helped create a Cold War culture shaped by fear and truth, or lack of it, scientists came to the West as bearers of secrets about arsenals, nuclear and otherwise. In Horn's opinion, the real Cold Warriors were civilians, secret agents, physicists, mathematicians, computer scientists, economists, and other experts who allowed university research, espionage, and military war games to speculate jointly about the enemy. These warriors presented a security risk on both sides of the Iron Curtain, as each side was in the pursuit of knowledge and intelligence. There are lists of mathematicians, physicists, and secret agents or officers who crossed the Iron Curtain, some over Western Europe to the United States, and others from the United States to the Soviet Union, the People's Republic of China, and East Germany, among other countries. As far-fetched as the U.S. TV show The Americans may seem, the KGB spies portrayed in this highly successful series are based on true stories that are stranger than fiction. An almost carbon-copy story is that of the KGB spies Andrei Bezrukhov, Donald Heathfield, and Yelena Vavilova, Tracy Foley, who, like the protagonists of The Americans, led normal American lives but were part of a Soviet program that dispatched deep-cover agents called illegals. However, after the fall of communism, they continued to spy for the SVR, Služba vnešnej razvedky, Foreign Intelligence Service of the Russian Federation, the successor of the KGB in modern Russia. As occurred so many times with exposed agents, Bezrukhov and Vavilova were swapped for Russians who were spying for the United States. Two of the most important defectors to the West, who inflicted serious blows to their respective Cold War intelligence agencies, were the East German Vana Stila and the Romanian Ion Mihai Pacepa. The East German double agent Stila left with a briefcase full of top-secret files and documents that were meant to assure his survival, but also to allow him to prove his worth to the West. Most notably, the information that Stiller gave to the West German Secret Service helped visually identify Markus Wolf, the longtime director of the Stasi's main directorate for reconnaissance, until then known as the Man Without a Face. Stiller eventually also collaborated with the CIA and made it to the United States, where he lived the American dream for a while under a new identity as an investment broker. Before he died at the age of 69 in Budapest, he was eager to talk about his life as a spy and his fear for his life. Pacepa was a Securitate General, head of Romanian industrial espionage, and personal advisor to Nicolae Ceaușescu. After his defection in 1978, he worked with the CIA on various operations against the Eastern Bloc, and the agency described his contribution as important and unique. His first book, Red Horizons, Chronicles of a Communist Spy Chief, 1987, in which, according to other former Securitate officers, he laid bare truths, half-truths, and outright fiction about the communist regime in Romania, the Ceaușescu couple, and covert Eastern Bloc operations, was serialized on Radio Free Europe in 1988. Pacepa was sentenced to death twice in absentia and continues to live in hiding in the United States. While many of these defection and spy stories are still veiled in secrecy due to security concerns, the end of the Cold War presented a unique opportunity in the East. The opening of the secret police files, which helped researchers unearth stories of victims and collaborators, but also of secret operations. Yet the lustration process in the various former Eastern Bloc countries did not evolve without glitches and, in some cases, serious hurdles. The former communist secret services did not surrender power without a last attempt to cover their traces. For instance, both the East German Stasi and the SRI, Serviciul Roman de Informații, Romanian Service of Information, the successor of the Romanian Securitate, proceeded to destroy files in 1989 and 1991, respectively. The shredded Stasi files are currently undergoing a meticulous process of recovery that began with the ePuzzler, a reconstruction software that uses complex image processing and pattern recognition algorithms to reconstruct scanned shreds of paper into complete pages, and has now switched to manual mending. The partially burned and buried Romanian Securitate files, uncovered by Romanian journalists, could only be recovered to some extent, and the irremediable loss of information remains to be assessed. Yet the remaining almost intact files allow us rare insight into the life and activity of various intelligence officers and informers, as discussed in Part 1. Chapter 1 focuses on the former Securitate officer Samuel Feld, who, on February 29, 1960, was discharged from MAI, Ministerul Afacerilor Interne, Ministry of Internal Affairs. Feld's file story, as composed by Valentina Glajar, reveals a fragmented, often embellished, other times conflicting account that retraces his 11-year career as a Securitate officer and the two investigations into his life and activity that eventually led to his dismissal. Based on Feld's Cater file and his surveillance files, opened under the codename Dayan after his dismissal from MAI, Glajar's analysis exposes, in part, the inner workings of the Securitate at its core, but also offers a slice of Jewish-Romanian personal history that speaks of anti-Semitism, persecution, and, ultimately, false hopes. The case against Major Feld was based on informers' reports, characterizations by his colleagues, anonymous denouncements, and interrogations that are only alluded to but most likely removed from or never included in this file. Yet, like an apt chess player, he anticipated his investigators' moves, always ready to provide them with elaborate explanations for his activities and often successfully outmaneuvering them. As Glajar shows, Feld knew how to skillfully influence the unfolding of his own story, at least up to the point when it inescapably slipped out of his hands and followed his investigators' desired trajectory. Several years after his dismissal, Feld managed to emigrate with his family to the United States, after several failed attempts to emigrate to Israel. While he expressed regrets about having been entangled with the Securitate, he also requested that his real name be obscured in this chapter. In Chapter 2, Mary Beth Stein tackles the story of East Germany's greatest spymaster, Markus Wolf, whom Western intelligence agencies simply dubbed the Man Without a Face for 25 years. Unlike in Feld's case, though, Wolf's three personnel files comprise roughly 100 pages, and the information they entail hardly allows one to evaluate truth claims about him or espionage operations in his autobiographies. As Stein claims, the Man Without a Face might have remained the Man Without a Trace had it not been for his many autobiographical publications. In this chapter, Stein focuses specifically on Wolff's 1997 English-language autobiography, co-authored with Anne McElvoy, The Man Without a Face, and a revised and expanded German edition published in 1997 under the title Spionchef im Geheimen Krieg, Erinnerungen. Like other Stasi officers who penned their autobiographical stories, Wolff's German and English language editions are critical in his own campaign for personal redemption and a more positive assessment of the East German state. Drawing on Philippe Lejeune's autobiographical pact, Stein explores truth claims about Wolff himself and the controversial espionage practice of using Romeo spies, and his reflections on the legacy of East German socialism at a time when he and the system he served were on trial. In Chapter 3, Alison Lewis turns to the role of Stasi informers in the Stasi's secret war on books, namely, informers who wrote readers' reports on a clandestine basis for the Stasi as the fifth censor of literature. In the absence of autobiographical testimony, the Cold War spy story of Stasi informer and minor poet Uwe Berger, namely, I am inoffizieller Mitarbeiter, Uwe, is composed mainly from the extensive and telling traces left behind in his file in the Stasi archives. Enlisted in 1972, Berger reviewed and mostly tried to sabotage the publication of works by a string of notable East German writers, Sarah Kirsch, Paul Wiens, Monika Maron, Günter Kunert, Klaus Poche, Erich Löst, Lutz Rathenow, Wolfgang Hilbig, Eva Strittmatter, Jurek Becker, and Bettina Wegner. Lewis discusses the various facets of this informer's self-ascribed role as an aesthetic gatekeeper and an ideological policeman in the field of literature, as well as Uwe's role as a secret agent. As she argues in this chapter, working undercover as a freelance reader for the Stasi provided Berger with a chance to work off personal grievances and resentments, as well as to bank greater symbolic, albeit secret, capital for himself as a member of what he and others saw as an elite secret surveillance society. Part 2 explores the making of targets by two secret police forces, Romania's Securitate and the Soviet Union's KGB. Instrumental in the process through which an individual metamorphosed into a target was information gathered from informers. Collected in classified files, it provided the secret police with intelligence on the persons under observation and aided in building a case against these targets. In Chapter 4, for example, Corina L. Petrescu focuses on the French-Romanian writer Anna Novats and analyzes how she became a Securitate target in the early 1960s. Petrescu proposes the term target identity to describe the specific features and particular behaviors that the Securitate pieced together in individuals' files, and which allowed the Securitate to treat these individuals as suspicious and surveil them. By analyzing in detail the reports that two informers, called sources in the Romanian context, produced about Novats, she showcases the role these sources played in the criminalization of targeted regime critics. Irrespective of Novats' true nature, sources Magda and Karl Fischer first painted and then cemented target Novats into an enemy of the state, both ideologically, through her openly articulated criticism, and personally, in terms of lifestyle and expectations. While Novats was able to escape Romania due to her intuition that she would be able to do so only if she thwarted the Securitate, Petrescu's engagement with her files also illustrates how persistent secret police forces could be in their pursuit of targets. As a French citizen in the 1980s, Novotz captured the Securitate's attention again due to her collaborations with Radio Free Europe, and the reports of sources Magda and Carl Fischer gained relevance anew. In Chapter 5, Julie Fedor shows how in 1980, the KGB stage-managed the case of Orthodox priest Father Dmitry Dudko so as to recast the heroic image of the dissident into that of a marionette of Western secret services. By examining the worldview of the Czechist and the manner in which he conceived of and categorized Soviet citizens, Fedor retraces the distinctive moral universe of the KGB. She focuses on Dudko as a KGB target and approaches the topic from his perspective as a victim by examining a series of autobiographical writings in which Dudko attempted to come to terms with his past decades after his direct confrontation with the Soviet system. Dudko's ultimate conversion into a regime loyalist allows Fedor to scrutinize his works for insights into the categories that fueled the Czechist discourse of the Cold War and how they permeated Dudko's own thinking. The trope of repentance becomes a key element not only of this discourse, but also of Dudko's autobiographical output and of the accounts put forth by his contemporaries. In an attempt to further explain Dudko's actions, Fedor also explores the post-Soviet life of Dudko's story and its appropriation by contemporary Russian nationalists. With the set goal of recasting Cold War history in the service of a grand Russian narrative dominated by the confrontation between Russia and the West, these nationalists refashion the KGB and, implicitly, also the Cheka, as a valiant protector of Russian spirituality. Part 3 is devoted to Cold War stories with a transnational East-West European focus. Most Cold War studies proceed from the assumption that the Iron Curtain was impassable and that there was a strict bipolarity between East and West superpowers. However, as recent research in Finland shows, there was a far greater degree of multi-level interaction between the different types of actors, between people, institutions, and states that belies this view. Satellite states did not always act in monolithic ways, and parts of Europe, such as the two Germanies, served as an arena of collaboration rather than confrontation, as we shall hear in the next two chapters by Jennifer Miller and Axel Hildebrandt. The motif of the Iron Curtain implies a rigid, impassable physical border as well as a metal-like mental border. Yet for many, the Iron Curtain leaked and was passable both physically and ideologically. This applied particularly to those residents of both East and West Berlin living geographically in close proximity to the wall as a physical edifice, or to those living along the internal border in Germany, a country that shared the same language and cultural traditions. In Chapter 6, Jennifer Miller unearths a little-known area of collaboration during the Cold War involving espionage and Turkish nationals. This East-West spy story, or rather this interlocking web of intriguing smaller spy narratives, allowed for a more intimate kind of collaboration at a grassroots level among residents of divided Berlin. As Miller reveals, West Berlin residing Turkish nationals built social lives, business deals, intimate relationships, and transnational families across divided Berlin, offering new perspectives on the lived experience of divided Berlin and the Cold War from a German perspective. For Germans and their respective governments, Turkish guest workers presented, as Miller argues, a paradox, since they were seen as suspicious on both sides. Foreign in the West and a security risk in the East. For the East German Stasi, moreover, they posed a new kind of capitalist threat, especially the many regular border crossers among Turks who formed relationships with East German women, often as a prelude to helping the women escape. For the Turks, the East seemed to offer a space to explore and enjoy greater social autonomy and acceptance among Germans. As Miller explores, through close analysis of various sources, including personal and departmental Stasi files, Turkish border crossers were kept under strict surveillance on their sojourns in the East, often as targets under suspicion of some illicit activity, but sometimes as enlisted collaborators spying on fellow countrymen or East German women. In Chapter 7, Axel Hildebrandt excavates another unknown Cold War spy story and another area of collaboration between East and West Germans, this time one that extended to the United States and Poland. This chapter tells the backstory behind a major Cold War international incident in August 1978 involving terrorism and an illegal escape across the Iron Curtain. The story of a spectacular hijacking of a Polish airplane headed to East Berlin by two East Germans desperate to escape to the West and helped by a West German accomplice was well publicized in the West German media at the time. Hildebrandt composes a multimedial account from the memories of eyewitnesses, including the U.S. judge at the trial and the extensive Stasi records on each of the participants who were under constant surveillance. Hildebrandt compares factual and fictional versions of the event and analyzes the unique perspectives offered by each of the different types of narratives, the secret police files, the accounts of eyewitnesses, and some of the newer fictional treatments of the historical material, such as the novel Tupolev by Antje Ravik-Strubel. Rather than regarding one source as more truthful or accurate than the other, Hildebrandt explores instead how each source and narrative, the factual and the fictional, has contributed to our understanding of the Cold War along the frontier between East and West and has shaped our memory of this remarkable event. Part 4, Spies on Screen, focuses on fictional representations in film and television at the height of the Cold War and beyond. For the West, films were pivotal to exporting democracy and the values of freedom to the rest of the world, not just for the United States, but for NATO member countries as well. Nothing did this better than the spy film. The gentleman-like screen character of British secret agent James Bond has come to epitomize the figure of the Cold War spy, and the British-American film franchise has come to typify the genre of the spy thriller. Yet Eastern Bloc audiences were largely unfamiliar with Bond, and Bond mania remained a Western phenomenon. In the Eastern Bloc, a rather different kind of spy movie gained popularity. In Chapter 8, Carol Ann Costabile Hemming focuses on two lesser-known spy films made in the GDR. For Eyes Only, Streng Geheim, 1963, and Chiffriert An Chef, Auswahl Nummer 5, Coded Message for the Boss, 1979, produced by the state-owned film studio, the Deutsche Filmaktiengesellschaft, DEFA. Set in divided Berlin just prior to the building of the Berlin Wall, at a time of heightened tensions, both films modified the genre of the spy film and domesticated the figure of the double agent. They did so not as a form of escapism, but to lend support to dominant East German belief systems and the specific fear that East Germany was under threat of invasion from NATO forces. Moreover, as Costabile Hemming notes, GDR espionage films were tasked with clearly marking the rival while working to exclude and contain the enemy. As she shows, although set some 16 years apart, both films served to reactualize the threat from the U.S. enemy around the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis and the Berlin Crisis, 1958 to 1961, to shore up support for GDR domestic politics, particularly the regime's intransigent stance on its closed borders. In Chapter 9, Lisa Hegele explores West German film perspectives on the spy genre and turns to a critically acclaimed but little-known example of new German cinema and spy film, Der Willy Busch Report, The Willy Busch Report, 1979, by Swiss-born Niklaus Schilling. Schilling chooses a decidedly atypical setting for his espionage film in an uneventful, fictional town along the inner German frontier. The film relocates the conflict from the international to the West German national. At the same time, it serves to refocus the problems of the Cold War from a novel perspective, which is not them, but rather us, the Germans. As a spy story about spy stories, Der Willy Busch Report provides a humorous, close-up German view of the Cold War and of the spy genre. It takes an ironic approach, both to Cold War politics and to espionage, offering a counter-aesthetic not only to the Bond films of the time, but also to post-Cold War Hollywood-style productions such as Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck's Oscar-winning Das Leben der Anderen, The Lives of Others, 2006. By creating narrative ambiguities and subverting spy film tropes, the film draws attention to the issues of surveillance, hysteria, and paranoia in West Germany shortly after the German autumn in 1977, when West Germany was shaken by the terrorist attacks of the Red Army faction. Chapter 10 by Cheryl Duke moves from the Cold War to the post-Cold War era, in which films and television series about Cold War espionage, many of which are transnational productions, are enjoying a renaissance. As she shows, rather than expressing a nostalgia for Cold War certainties and old binaries between friend and foe, many filmic variations of the spy thriller, such as Westen, Bridge of Spies, 2015, and Deutschland 83, 2015 to the present, muddy the waters of the old dichotomies between East and West, enemy and friend. They speak to the changed geopolitical situation after 1990 and to the new concerns of a post-political era. In her readings of spy films since 2010, she reveals how the aesthetics of surveillance provide a conduit for national stories to travel internationally, which in turn allows these works to make meaningful contributions to current post-Cold War debates about surveillance. The principal means by which they do so is the use of political and moral ambiguity, conveyed through filmic devices such as blurring, framing, reflections, and representation of affect, as well as narrative. They thus have a double referent in the Cold War past and the post-Cold War present, addressing memories of the all-pervasive climate of fear and mistrust during the Cold War and our current concern with all mechanisms of surveillance. However, as Duke argues, the politics of surveillance has indeed changed since the end of the Cold War, as have its means and forms. Anxieties about spying and surveillance, too, have shifted, and, as she argues, if the spy comes from within, spy thrillers about internal surveillance speak compellingly to contemporary anxieties about the kind of liquid surveillance that is conducted worldwide through digital monitoring. If the Cold War, from a U.S. perspective, was about defense of the West, in the post-Cold War era, U.S. foreign policy was about the political and ideological extension of the West. Despite U.S. hopes that the dissolution of the Soviet Union would lead to a lasting transformation of Russian society that would also see Russia become a friendly power, after 2000, relations between the United States and Russia soured as Russia went backward politically, becoming a less open, less tolerant, less democratic, more repressive place. With NATO's expansion eastward, in particular, Vladimir Putin began to see the United States and NATO as rivals again, and Russia moved to aggressively protect what it saw as its interests in its region, which culminated in its 2014 invasion of neighbor and former Soviet republic Ukraine. As Michael Mandelbaum writes, Russian resentment, in concert with Russian autocracy, put an end to the peaceful post-Cold War era on the European continent. While the post-Cold War era challenged many of the certainties of the Cold War and its binaries, sometimes inverting fixed reference points of friend and foe, it has also revealed some uncomfortable continuities with the past. As we shall show, there are many constants, such as the shared belief in the universality of American freedom, democracy, and free enterprise, that link both the Truman and the George W. Bush eras of foreign policy. In post-Soviet Russia as well, the Soviet past in particular is being rehabilitated as Putin, who was a colonel in the KGB, has surrounded himself with secret police veterans who form the core of Putin's new authoritarian Russian political system. Moreover, as Russian interference in the 2016 U.S. elections has revealed, we are in many ways witnessing a revival of the information wars of the Cold War, which are now being fought through the new social media. These ideological front lines continue to run between NATO and Warsaw Pact member states, albeit along a frontier that has now moved eastward and continues to shape political and cultural life in the United States, Europe, and Russia. This is nowhere more evident than in the phenomenon of so-called fake news, which is nothing more than what during the Cold War went under the epithet of disinformation. Similarly, in Russia today, in what is now being dubbed a new Cold War, there are attempts to resume past cultural wars, especially the wars against church-led dissidents, which the Soviet Union lost to the West, and to try to win back the hearts and minds of former dissenters. Yet despite the Sonderweg taken by Russia under Putin with regard to the KGB, the remainder of the former Soviet bloc states have embraced lustration in dealing with former elites and its secret police forces, making their archives available to researchers and victims. This open and democratic approach to the past has allowed the forensic search for the truth to proceed unimpeded, fostering the work of historians and other researchers. By the same token, the declassification of archival sources has also allowed other kinds of mediation of the Cold War past to flourish. Especially in recent years, we have seen a wide array of new types of stories, films, television series, and works of fiction that have continued the search for truth into other media and fora and experimented with new interpretations and perspectives on the past. Espionage was undoubtedly a rich field to mine during the Cold War, although much of this field was obscured from view. The exposure of this explosive seam of facts and fiction, truth and lies, has revealed a fascinating and productive source of knowledge about espionage. For both the historian and the creator of fictional works in the post-Cold War period, this presents both a formidable challenge and a unique opportunity. Part 1. Intelligence Officers and Informers. 1. The File Story of the Securitate Officer Samuel Feld. Valentina Glajar. On February 29, 1960, Major Samuel Feld, a Jewish Romanian secret police officer, was discharged from MAI, Ministerul Afacerilor Interne, Ministry of Internal Affairs, Region Stalin, Brasov. The decision number 1426 to release him cites the Statute of the Officers and Generals Corps, Article 52, Paragraph D. Up until his discharge, he had been the chief of the counter-espionage and interrogation services. A closer look at his file explains this dismissal and the reasons behind the official citation as grave transgressions that are now partly redacted in his file. His failure to denounce crimes, joining the Securitate under false pretexts, his disrespect for the workers and peasants' classes, his Zionist ties, and his relatives abroad were among the main accusations that led to Feld's downfall. As was customary in such cases, Feld was also expelled from the Romanian Communist Party and had to return all the medals and honors he had received during his 11-year career in the service of the Securitate. Finally, he also signed a statement that he would not divulge any professional secrets he had been privy to as an officer and interrogation expert of MAI, Region Stalin. Feld belonged to the first generation of Romanian Secret Service, Securitate agents, during the Stalinist years of the Cold War. The political changes in Romania at that time called for a restructuring of the intelligence organizations that would reflect the needs of the newly proclaimed People's Republic in 1947 and the demands of the Soviet military presence on its territory. Thus, the Securitate had a particular type of spy in mind. Young individuals, up to 30 years of age, with a healthy, non-bourgeois social origin, who exhibited feelings of devotion to the communist cause and manifested love and appreciation for the Soviet Union. These criteria are not surprising, as Soviet officers, also called counselors or advisors, consiglieri, closely supervised the selection and recruitment of this first generation of Securitate officers. These new agents came mainly from poor working-class families, and their education level was in many cases very low, at times just a handful of elementary classes. As a result, obedient and uneducated individuals from a politically healthy social background joined the Secret Service and were later promoted less on the value of their achievements, but rather on the desired characteristics and aforementioned credentials on their resumes. As historian Florian Banu shows, the qualifications proved an ill-fated combination that, coupled with frequent moves and a sense of careerism, led in many cases to extra-conjugal affairs, in the lingo of the Securitate, deviation from the proletarian moral, and chronic alcoholism. This, as Banu further explains, led in turn to the violence and brutality that would come to characterize Securitate officers of the Romanian Stalinist era. As I will show in this chapter, Samuel Feld's background fitted the required profile only to some extent, as his own Securitate files reveal. While he could claim a healthy social background and an apparent devotion to the Communist Party, his education and superior intelligence, coupled with his Jewish origins, later proved to have fateful consequences for his career and, indeed, his life. When read meticulously and against the grain, Feld's Securitate files reveal a multi-layered story in the highly politicized context of Stalinist Romania. The reality of this story was shaped and recreated by various actors, not least by our protagonist, who tailored his biography in favorable ways to fit ideologies at certain times during his career. Denouncers or fellow Securitate officers contributed to this story and were instrumental in undoing our protagonist's version of events. The deictic presence of investigators, exemplified through the red markings on the documents, reveal a third dimension to the story, one that at times invoked their attitude toward the content or a general sense of urgency. They all tell a story about Feld's opportunity to join the Secret Service, his rise to power, his false sense of invulnerability, pronounced hubris, and ultimately, his retrospectively inevitable dismissal. His story, like other stories one can excavate from files, contains life segments, factual and skewed as viewed through the eyes of the secret police, which allow us rare insight into an officer's life. An officer who was both the subject and the object of surveillance and investigation. In John Froh's words, genres create the effects of reality and truth that are central to the different ways one understands the world in writing of history. Feld's story is neither entirely false nor true. It is simply a file story whose performative structure, as Froh reminds us, shapes the world and truth of an individual life. A file story, as I define it, is a form of remedial life writing, one that unravels skewed life segments coded and recorded in secret police files and recovers them through a multi-layered and polyphonic biographical act. In order to compose a file story, one needs to interpret not only the often disjointed pieces afforded in a file, documents, informers' notes, officers' reports, denunciations, investigations, interrogations, phone-tapping transcripts, etc., but also the omissions, distortions, and insinuations, as Igal Halfin points out in his study of Red autobiographies and the Bolshevik self. Connecting the dots and fording the various gaps entails also interpreting parties' attitudes, veiled hostility, and purpose. The result is a precarious and capricious collage that represents a compelling life story, yet any overlooked or missing detail has the potential of disturbing or rearranging the life fragments of this volatile file story. In the same vein, the central character of such a file story cannot necessarily be equated with the historical person, but must rather be regarded as the protagonist abstracted from his files and the lead performer in our file story. Feld's records reveal a rather complicated file story, one that exposes, in part, the inner workings of the Securitate at its core, but also one that offers a slice of a Jewish-Romanian personal history that speaks of anti-Semitism, persecution, and ultimately false hopes, during a period the political scientist Vladimir Tismaninu calls Stalinism Unbound. While the material comprised in his files reflects a fragmented, often embellished, other times conflicting account of his activity, the Securitate investigations into Feld's activity allow us rare insights into the life of a disgraced officer. Similar to the incriminating cases in Strictly Victim files, the case against Major Feld was based on informers' reports, characterizations by his colleagues, anonymous denunciations, and interrogations that are only alluded to but most likely removed from or never included in this file. His cadre file story ends with an arrest, also absent from the files, and his discharge from MI In spite of several commendations and medals received for outstanding work in the service of Mai Timishwara and Orashul Stalin, at the core of this investigation lies also a pronounced anti-Semitism that, on the one hand, motivated young Feld to join the Communist Party in 1945 and then the Securitate in 1948, and on the other, likely played a role in his eventual dismissal from the MAI and his exclusion from the party in 1960. His cadre file, like a captivating detective novel, begins with the denouement and invites the intrigued reader to discover how the case against this officer had been built and how the story unfolded. The protagonist comes to life through the eyes of others, but also through his own self-fashioning narratives, the intervallic autobiographies he had to compose for the purpose of record-keeping. At times, depending on the political requirements of any given day, these bureaucratic autobiographies allowed new details to emerge, like short, precise brushstrokes refining a painter's self-portrait. If one understands autobiographical storytelling as a recitation of a recitation, and an autobiography as a story of a story, then Feld was a master at telling and retelling his life story. He polished his memories to reflect his background in the most favorable light and to highlight each accomplishment to his utmost advantage. He knew how to adapt to the various political requirements of the changing times, and like a chess player, he anticipated his investigators' moves, always ready to provide them with elaborate explanations for his activities and often successfully outmaneuvering them. He created a self-censored, self-fashioned, and politically expedient personal history that allowed him to rise from wretched conditions and to remain in the elite service of the Securitate for 11 years. Feld, who would become the victim in this case, unlike average citizens who were often unaware that they had become targets of the Securitate, knew how to skillfully influence the unfolding of his own story, at least up to the point when it inescapably slipped out of his hands and followed his investigator's desired trajectory. Not only was our protagonist informed about the various accusations brought against him at certain points in his career, he was also allowed to react to them by manipulating the information and choreographing a new advantageous version of events that, as I will show, often barely corresponded to or predictably contradicted the already staged reality. He deftly and cunningly exploited his own investigative skills and experience, which, at least in his opinion, were superior in competence and aptitude to those of his colleagues and certainly to those of the lower-ranked officers, whom he apparently treated with conceit and disdain. Filed autobiographical sketches. From the various mandatory autobiographies and biographical questionnaires Feld drafted or filled out over the years for the Securitate, a compelling story unfolds, one he sometimes specifically altered by adding or leaving out various details pertaining to him or his family. From an autobiography drafted in 1948, we learn that he was born in Ushorod, then in the Soviet Union on April 30, 1927, but moved with his family to the city of Timișoara in western Romania at a very early age. About his parents, a mandatory topic in these autobiographies, we learn that his father, Jakob, had been deported to Buchenwald, and his mother, Ella, had been residing in a village in the then newly founded State of Israel since 1946. Feld explained that he had attended the Israelite primary school in District 4 in Timișoara. Interestingly, he wrote and crossed out the first three letters of Josephine, the original name of the neighborhood and then added the new official name, D-102, where he did not have to pay school taxes and could also benefit from consistent warm meals. He went on to enroll in the Israelite Lycée, a reputable high school in Timișoara, and graduated the first 4 years in 1942. During the summer of the same year, he found employment with two well-to-do Jewish families, Csendes and Fischhoff, where he performed odd jobs such as splitting wood or peeling vegetables. In 1943, at the age of 16, he replaced his older brother, Atul, who, along with other Jewish men between the ages of 18 and 45, had been enlisted in so-called work teams that were in reality forced labor squads. In spite of his age, Feld worked at the town's nursery in his brother's stead, while Atua looked for black market employment opportunities in order to support their family. After having established his healthy social background, as he came from a very poor rather than a bourgeois capitalist family, Feld highlighted his brief yet substantial activity within the Communist Party organizations up to 1948. His resume included joining Uniunii Tineretului Comunist, UTC, Union of the Communist Youth, in January 1944, organizing the Jewish youth at the Israelite Lycée, and joining the Communist Party in 1945. The same year, he began his career with the secret police as commissar aide at the Siguranța Timișoara. In 1946, he joined the Information Bureau at the Communist Party Committee Timișoara. A year later, he was in charge of propaganda at the Tineretul Progresist, Progressive Youth, which was dissolved a few months later. After passing the entrance examination at the law school in Cluj, he requested to be allowed to join the workforce in order to save money for college. He was thus allowed to transfer to the Federation of Cooperatives Banat, where his financial situation apparently worsened due to a lower-than-expected salary, and where he faced anti-Semitic remarks from the president himself, who allegedly stated that a Jew had no place at Federala. Evidently remaining determined to serve the communist cause, the young Feld went on to organize the youth at the Federala within Uniunii Tineretului Muncitoresc, UTM, Union of the Working Youth, where he rose through the ranks all the way to the regional UTM committee. His biography depicts a confusing and meandering path that reflects the rapid changes within and dissolutions of the communist youth organizations, but at times also his exuberant and vivacious view of the world. One sentence in particular strikes one as offbeat in this serious world of rapid, life-altering transformations and allows us to see him as just a young man who saw girlfriends as a distraction from his important work in the service of the party. "I decided to abandon a bourgeois girl who took too much of my time." While it seems odd that he, the party enthusiast, could become entangled with a bourgeois girl, he knew to sacrifice this relationship for the sake of the party. In another rendition of his past, an autobiography dated April 11, 1951, further details about his life and activity emerge in a comprehensive account that comprises more than 6 typed pages. For the most part, it reiterates the political engagement in the communist organizations, but offers more details about Feld's family and a list of most likely mandatory references for each segment of his life and each workplace. While in his 1948 biographical story he indicated that his father had been killed in Buchenwald, he rectified this by merely alluding to his death, as he simply indicated that his father had been deported and never returned, We further learn that his father had worked for many years as a day laborer, but since he had a beautiful singing voice, he joined a church choir. There is no mention of a temple or synagogue, although Feld never actively denied his Jewish origins. Furthermore, he related that his father had abandoned the family, his mother and his other siblings, when Feld was 8. The father then moved from Romania to northern Transylvania, which after 1940 became part of Hungary, remarried, and was deported with his new family to a Nazi extermination camp. Some details about the other members of Feld's family, including his mother, earned some red, blue, and pencil underlining, as they were apparently of interest to Feld's superiors who reviewed his autobiography. First, the fact that Feld, a Securitate officer, had been writing to his mother in Israel. Also significant to his future investigators was Feld's intention to marry a UTM member, whose background he intended to investigate prior to asking for the Securitate's approval. In a ficha individuale, individual chart, that Feld signed on May 28, 1952, we learn that he had married A.C., the aforementioned UTM member, whose family strongly opposed the marriage. According to the information in this chart, A.C.'s family had in fact an undesirable social and political background that would prove to be consequential in Feld's investigation. They had been closely associated with the historical parties and owned various properties in Bucharest prior to August 23, 1944, when Romania joined the Allies and declared war on Nazi Germany. In a biographical questionnaire that Feld filled out and signed on November 16, 1955, new details surface, including his complete name, Samuel Jacob Feld. In addition to his baccalaureate obtained at the Israelite Lycée, he had also attended a Marxist-Leninist school at the University of Timișoara from 1949 to 1951. We learn that he actually wanted to become a doctor, but due to his active role in the party, he abandoned the idea of higher education, which contradicts his earlier statement that he abandoned his law studies in Cluj due to financial difficulties. By November 1955, he had been promoted to the rank of captain and transferred to Region Stalin. As his resume details, Feld had enrolled in the Securitate as Sublocotenent, second lieutenant, at the recommendation of Officer Martin Schnellbach on February 14, 1949. For the previous year, he had offered his services as Informatorul number 2. Informer number 2, of which several informative notes are included in his cadre file. By April 1951, he had been promoted twice already, to Locotenent, first lieutenant, in February 1950, and the same year on August 23rd to Locotenent Major, senior lieutenant. We also learn that he was an athletic type, and he participated as a rower and a rowing trainer in the organization Regatta in Timișoara from 1946 to 1947, which coincides with the time he worked as lucrator da informati, information worker, at the Information Bureau of the Regional Communist Party Committee. He was fluent or conversant in several foreign languages: Hungarian, his native tongue, German, French, Italian, and Hebrew. The last autobiography in Feld's cadre file is dated September 3, 1958, around the time that the second investigation into his past and career was initiated, and comprises 13 handwritten pages. Among the new details regarding his marital status, Feld also addressed the recurring lines of inquiry into the whereabouts of his father and his correspondence with his family residing in unfriendly, non-communist countries like Israel. He carefully crafted an explanation to distance himself from his Jewish family. About his father, he specified for the first time that he was brutal and unfaithful to his mother, which led to the parents' divorce in 1936. Feld cautiously stuck with the vague formulation of "he never returned" from the extermination camps, rather than that he died there, which later proved to be untrue and, according to the red markings, did not escape his investigators. Feld attempted to fend off any suspicions regarding his ongoing correspondence with his mother, an Israeli citizen. He vehemently denied it and indicated that he did not even know her address, but would inquire about it and provide it at a later time. His brother, Atul, who was also residing in Israel, appears as an undesired afterthought. As Feld claimed, he had cut any ties with his brother after he had deserted one of the aforementioned work teams and fled to British Palestine in 1944. In this same last biographical sketch, Feld addressed accusations pertaining to his relationship with Zionist organizations dating back to 1939 and with other imperialist organizations from 1947 to 1949. Simple math would solve his predicament. As Feld reminded his superiors and investigators, he could not have been a Zionist at the age of 12. While various Zionist organizations were present and active among the Jewish community, he spent time with these organizations as a child to benefit from free meals and clothes. Regarding the second accusation about his relationship with Western imperialist organizations, he cleverly veered the conversation toward his accomplishments as Securitate Informer Number 2. "I succeeded within several months to bring valuable informative materials, intelligence, from the English Library, from America's Friends, from the Institute of Italian Culture, and from the Zionist organizations of Timișoara." The materials had been exploited in the Securitate's activity. Therefore, he had to visit the various places and get in touch with members of these organizations in order to provide the valuable intelligence he acquired from them. In more detail, Feld highlighted his aversion to the former bourgeois system and the way he was exploited from an early age. As with the explanation for his involvement in the Zionist movement, Feld returned to his childhood and youth to dispel accusations about his bourgeois lifestyle, a time when his profile still mostly fitted the desired social and ideological background of a Securitate officer. As such, his story appears as a carbon copy of that of numerous Romanian Jews who were lured into the party by what Liviu Rotman has called the siren's song. While at times Feld's narrative seems forced and sounds disingenuous, his recollections of his poverty-stricken childhood in a profoundly anti-Semitic society, further cemented and legitimized by racial laws, sound genuine and heartfelt. He was 15 in 1942 when he began to work from 6 a.m. to 2 p.m., while also attending school in the afternoons from 3 p.m. to 10 p.m. His experiences working for the aforementioned rich Jewish families or at the spool factory, Juliana, where he was paid less because as a Jew he could not be employed with proper paperwork, evolved into hatred for the regime of bourgeois and landowners that was hitting him with full force. In this last autobiographical rendition of his life, Feld spares no details in his attempt to construct a persuasive portrayal of a zealous communist by reminding his investigators of his very poor beginnings and the anti-Semitic persecution he had faced. As expected, Feld associates the new communist regime with equality and prosperity for the working class. However, by the time he wrote this last autobiography in 1958, Felt's situation had changed considerably, as he then belonged to the elite and powerful organization of Securitate officers rather than to the poor working class he evoked in his autobiography. Yet his storytelling proved to be a futile exercise in the eyes of his investigators, whose particular accusations Feld could not counter by simply invoking his early credentials, no matter how persuasive his plea.